Welcome to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Today's Great Conversation takes us back into the Australian Classics Book Club. Now, the Aussie Classics Book Club is a monthly exploration of Australian writing, looking back over the forgotten, the classic, the much discussed, and the underappreciated of Australian writing. Today's book club features Elena Gougoulis, editor at Text Publishing, and Romy Ash, the author of Floundering, and together we'll be discussing Joan Lindsay's Picnic at Hanging Rock. I'm Andrew Popel, and every week I broadcast Final Draft from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. We record on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, and I acknowledge the traditional custodians, their ongoing connection to the land. Land that was never ceded, always was and always will be Aboriginal land. In Final Draft, we explore the best of Australia's books, writing and literary culture. And the Australian Classics Book Club is a chance to look back and learn more about that culture and how it influences our reading. If you know someone who loves literature, then why not share the podcast with them? Books, I mean, I just think they're always better shared. And together, maybe you can start your own book club. Discover something new and share it with someone else. Hit subscribe, you'll get a great new episode every week. Now, Picnic at Hanging Rock tells the story of a group of students at the Appleyard College in the Macedon Ranges in Victoria. The group go on a picnic to Hanging Rock on Valentine's Day in 1900. As the afternoon wears on, a group of the students go out to investigate the rock. The rest of the party rest in a drowsy torpor, that is, until one of the girls returns hysterical, for the other three have disappeared completely. Join me as we discuss and discover Joan Lindsay's Picnic at Hanging Rock. My name is Andrew Popel, and it is time for the Australian Classics Book Club. A monthly event, although we're running a week late, where we go back and discover, rediscover great Australian writing, things that tell us a little bit about who we are. And today is, some would say, perhaps arguably one of the greatest Australian novels. We can talk about that perhaps later. But first, I want to introduce my guests in the book club. I am joined by Romy Ash. Romy is the author of Floundering, which was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Prize, as well as the Prime Minister's Literary Awards and the Commonwealth Writers' Prize. Romy, welcome to the book club.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I am also joined by Elena Gougoulis. She is an editor at Text Publishing. She's also a regular guest here in the Aussie Classics Book Club. You will have heard her voice before, and it is always a pleasure. Elena?
Hi, Andrew. Hi, Romy.
Hi.
Now, without further ado, it's probably time to tell people the book. I did tease it last week because people like to know what's coming up, but we are talking about Picnic at Hanging Rock from Joan Lindsay, a book that I think for many people has resonances and thoughts and memories, and as I discovered, they're not all accurate. But before we get to the book, Elena, can you please introduce us to Joan Lindsay?
I can. So Joan Lindsay was born right at the end of the 19th century in Melbourne into a prominent Melbourne family known for its participation in the arts, among other things. She attended a school that was much like the Appleyard College of Picnic at Hanging Rock and seemed to serve as part of the inspiration for it. She was originally trained as a visual artist, actually, and she was married to Sir Darryl Lindsay, who, of course, is an artist, and she moved in those circles. Her first book was written in 1936, and it was a kind of parody of travel books that were really popular at the time. And then she didn't write her second for another 30 years, really, and that was Time Without Clocks, which is a kind of autobiographical memoir, if such a thing can be said to exist. And then Picnic at Hanging Rock was published in 1967, so just a few years after that, and that remains her most famous book, and indeed one of the most famous books of Australian literature. And it was adapted, of course, into the very famous feature film by Peter Weir in 1975. She did go on to write more books and essays and stories and novels and memoirs before her death in 1984.
So that is Joan Lindsay, and Picnic at Hanging Rock is, I think, a story that most Australians, or at least most Australians over a certain age, will have a passing familiarity with. It tells the story of a group of boarders at the Appleyard College in the Macedon Ranges in Victoria. The group go on a picnic to Hanging Rock on Valentine's Day 1900 in the company of two teachers. As the afternoon wears on, a group of students go to investigate the rock, only for one to return hysterical, with the others disappearing completely. The disappearance galvanizes the community and a search is held, but... And well, should I say any more or simply simply leave it for the reader to discover? Because that's the thing with Picnic at Hanging Rock. It's such a well-known story, but it can also, I think, seem to defy knowing and understanding. It has been thought to be a true story in its time. People have believed that, particularly around some of the sort of pseudo-historical elements in the text. It was the subject of a much-fated film by Peter Weir in 1975, and there was a series again last year. The mystery, I found, it invites and it confounds, and it feels like we all have our own relationship with it. And if I can share, for myself, I only vaguely remember seeing parts of the film when I was younger. And I know Peter Weir's cinematic style is very dreamy, especially in the film, and that's exactly what my memory of it is. But it's mixed with that childhood. But what I do have is this most definite memory of driving each year as a child from Sydney to Geelong to visit family. That's where my mum grew up. And as we would sort of be driving around that sort of Macedon Ranges area, my parents would talk about Hanging Rock. And they would also tell us stories of how the rocks in the area would move around. I have no idea where this came from, but of course we were kids, so we took this all on faith. And so it kind of, the whole area assumed for me this aura of magic and something sort of sinister, because I would always sort of wonder. I think the story that Mum and Dad told us was that the rocks would move at night when no one could see them. But I wondered what might happen if you were walking at night, if you were out at night and you were nearby when a rock decided to move around. This has no connection to the mythology of Picnic at Hanging Rock, but for me, it's inexplicably entwined. You can imagine this was an interesting book to read. Do either of you have personal anecdotes that make me seem a little less weird about this book?
I definitely don't have a personal anecdote of that level of weirdness, although I love it so much. But I had a really similar experience with remembering the book, like, and remembering the film, that it really, I just had these dreamy snatches. So when I reread it again, I was just astounded by the book itself, like what it was actually about and how it's really about these ripples rather than, you know, the event itself.
That struck me as well, and really I think what most people think of as the story is encapsulated in that very, very early first few chapters, and then it goes into, there are elements of adventure and mystery and almost sort of, there's a detective element that I think you note in your introduction, Romy. What about yourself, Elena? What was it like for you reading or even remembering this book?
Well, I suppose I have a weird anecdote, but it's a weird in a different way in that I actually had neither read the book nor seen the film until taking it on to work on it now for this edition. So I came to it completely fresh. I mean, obviously knowing the book's status in Australian literature and history and its resounding influence on other books, but no, I hadn't actually read it. So I don't know if that's because I'm from Perth and maybe it doesn't figure quite so prominently in the cultural imagination over there. But so I read this for the first time, which seems so bizarre to me, and I enjoyed it so much, but it also seems oddly appropriate given that it is a book essentially about time and that it's written in such a timeless way. I mean, you wouldn't, if you came to it fresh without knowing when it was published, you wouldn't think it was published in 1967, would you?
No, that was the thing, and it wasn't actually till you introduced Joan Lindsay, Elena, that I had this sort of strange flash about her own biography. And the book is set in 1900, so Joan Lindsay would have been four, turning five, at the time of the book. And my flashes, and I think some of your flashes you were describing there, Romy, are of a childhood sort of around that age, obviously not in 1900. But I wondered if you either of you had thought of that, and this idea that 1900 for Joan Lindsay would have been a magical time where mystery and some of the stranger elements would have been very much alive for her. Does that have anything to do with the setting?
I think certainly you'd there's quite a lot of Joan Lindsay's autobiography that seeps into this book, not least because so many people were suspicious of it as being based in fact. She herself was really fascinated by time, and had a really complex relationship to it, and she seemed to like the in the story where clocks and watches seem to stop randomly around the rock. That seemed to happen for Joan Lindsay as well. She couldn't keep a watch on or working because it would just consistently stop. So, and also the fact of that all the events of the book happen on Valentine's Day, which is a date that is particularly significant for Joan Lindsay. It's the date of her wedding anniversary, and it was a date that figured a lot in her kind of personal narrative of her life, and then the book itself, the story came out of a dream that she had that kind of coalesced into this book that was written in a fever after it. So I think that there's certainly a lot about probably her own early life that has found its way into this book, among many other things.
Yeah, I loved learning that about her, that she couldn't wear a watch, that time seemed to stop around her. It was just so cool to think about it.
I was fascinated by that as well, and this recurrence. And I think, Romy, you were the one that actually brought it to my attention that the way people keep drifting in and out of sleep makes it seem very much like elements of the narrative could be happening in that dreamlike state. But again, Elena, when you mention it, I thought, wow, she was a 4 or 5 year old child at the time of this, and so much of parts of this story have that element of a childlike sort of wonder, the dreamlike state, even the hero sort of rushing in, who's determined to solve this, although, you know, we can problematize that later. But yeah, that just really struck me, that there are those childlike elements, and that would have been Joan Lindsay at the time. I wanted to ask another, not a question, but maybe sort of float an idea that was occurring to me. And this, again, was something that you really interestingly connected in your intro, Romy, so I'd love to hear your ideas. And that's the way the mystical kind of works. And the thing that really struck me in the early part of the book, and this isn't giving too much away, they're on the picnic and the four girls have begged off to go for a walk and explore the rock before they're there to return to Appleyard College. And they encounter the other picnickers, and Albert sort of, does he give them a whistle? And everything is quite normal, and they're skirting the river, but they can't see the rock. It's made very clear that the rock is sort of obscured despite its size. And then they cross the river, and there's a bit of a to-do about how they're going to cross, and each of them in their own way. And it's actually reflected back on by, I think, Albert or Michael, how graceful, say, Miranda is versus the others. And then as soon as they cross the river, they can see the rock. The rock rises up above them. And this is where it gets weird. And it sort of struck me that, thinking back to elements of mythology and fairy stories, that rivers and running bodies of water like that actually can occupy a bit of a liminal zone in some of those more European-style mythologies. And again, I don't know that we'll ever know this, but this idea that crossing the river, that was the moment that it got weird, at least for the four young women, and that Joan Lindsay was actually connecting with some of this European-style mythology in this new land that she was sort of pointing out in contrast with the very Britishness of the college.
Yeah, when I think about that moment where they cross over, it almost feels like more like science fiction to me. Like, and especially if you read this this extra chapter, chapter 18, which was removed from Joan Lindsay's, removed from Picnic Rock before it was published, but then has been published now. And this chapter has sort of some answers to the mystery at the heart of the book, but they're sort of answers that are just sort of filled with all this weird uncanniness, like floating corsets and stuff that really defies like the laws of nature. And yeah, for me, I was just like, wow, this is almost science fiction.
I've now done two really weird sort of storytelling moments here. Does anyone want to bring this back to Earth or dive deeper?
Let's keep going. Let's go down, Andrew. Let's do it.
I actually, well, so Romy, when you mentioned that chapter, the missing chapter in your introduction, and that then really connected me back to this idea that was already gestating in my mind, and I was recalled back to those really early Irish mythologies, and particularly the wanderings of Oisin. And so Oisin was the son of Finn McCool from the poem The Toyn by Cooling, and Oisin is sort of spirited off to the fairy world, where he lives for, is it something like 1,000 years, and he returns, and I think the prohibition on him is that he can return, but he is not allowed to touch the earth. As soon as he touches the earth, he's re-centered, and he does, and he immediately ages, I think, incredibly quickly, and everyone's going to tweet in and tell me how wrong I'm getting this story. But it just sort of reminded me of this idea that maybe factoring in the clocks, that the young women had moved into this space where time operated differently, and they were in sort of a fairyland where perhaps they were still alive, but they were moving at a different temporal space. And we've turned Joan Lindsay into science fiction, haven't we?
That's what it says. Sorry, you go, Romy.
Oh, I'm just saying, maybe we're still waiting for them to come back, you know?
Exactly. That's what we ignored in the year 2000. It wasn't Y2K. Somewhere in Hanging Rock, three women. Oh, there's a spoiler. People are going to have to read the book. Three women have just sort of wandered out strangely, been rescued by Doctor Who and spirited off around the galaxy. Elena, you were starting to say about how that is very much an aspect of it.
Well, I think that it is. I mean, I think that really was a kind of proto sci-fi, or at least a proto Australian Gothic version of sci-fi, this book, and certainly the chapter that Romy refers to, chapter 18, that was excised from publication prior to publication and only kind of came out decades later. Makes the mystery a bit more clear in some ways and more opaque in other ways, in that the answer really is, if I can say it, I don't know if that's giving away too much, but that the girls say are lost in time rather than space. So yeah, as you say, they're somewhere, and perhaps they'll reappear. It's kind of an understanding of time that is not linear, which is really fitting with the kind of book and the way it's written, and with your experiences of it, I think, Andrew and Romy and many other people's as well, that it does exist in this really weird space that is both of its time and not of its time.
Can we talk a little bit about the Australian Gothic and this figuring of the landscape, and also a point that you make, Romy, which is that there's very much a colonial lens over this, and there is no real presence of the traditional owners, or that this is occupied land, that sort of terra nullius view, I think you put it in your introduction, Romy.
Yeah, well, I guess with white Australian fiction, there is this sort of process of, like, erasure, I guess. But I just think that this book is telling of its time, and I think, in the book, in my introduction, I reference Claudia Rankine and what she talks about, how imaginations are creatures as limited as we ourselves are. So, so Joan Lindsay would have been, you know, writing about the world that she knew, and that was definitely a colonial world. And yeah, it's kind of a white historical novel.
True that the way that it engages with the land is so, I mean, it's in a way, because Joan Lindsay's preoccupation is one of time rather than place, even though the landscape figures so prominently and so forcefully in the book, her understanding of place seems to exist in this abstract realm where it's about ideas rather than any kind of engagement with contemporary and, you know, issues that actually bind us to the earth and the land, which is not an excuse in at all. It's just, I think, it's really interesting to note it as a product of its time, given that it is so timeless in many other ways.
I was really interested in ways of knowing as well, because it does seem like Joan Lindsay is trying to engage with ways of knowing this land in the dynamic between Mike and Albert, where they create this strange friendship across their class. But Mike is very much this lonely, I feel like I should be using his full title, but I got all friendly with him as well, as I read. Mike is this very aristocratic recent transplant, whereas Albert is a young man who has sort of grown up on the land. And they have very different ways of knowing, and Mike sort of almost has to drag himself up, whereas Albert is always very casual with the situation. He's always at ease and seems to find Mike a curiosity in the way he kind of engages with everything to do with the land. And that contrast made that sort of sense of the Gothic very stark to me.
If we think about when the novel is set as well, 1900. I think it's just pre-Federation, so we have that this strong connection to Britain, and Mike, I kind of got quite friendly with him during the reading too. Yeah, he's representative of that, I think.
I think there is a kind of acknowledgement there that of the power of the landscape and that kind of the menace of it as well, that even it's not said in so many words, but it does seem like Joan Lindsay is tapping into ideas of a kind of spirit that is in the landscape inherent to it, which I think would actually seem to, you know, acknowledge that there's something deeper to it than the history of the country as we understand it.
Yeah, and that's what I found so incredibly interesting, Elena, because in the way that I was reading, I was seeing some sort of lens, some sort of overlay of these European, if not specifically British, mythological traditions. But Joan Lindsay was very much acknowledging the idea that whatever it was there, it existed. I didn't have a sense whether she was engaging with the fact that it pre-existed colonization. In fact, talking about it now, I'm very much sort of reminded of the works of authors like Neil Gaiman, where currently watching the Not Sure About How I Feel series of his novel American Gods, but this idea that mythologies and power exists in land, and it can then be overlaid by the people who come to the land. This is going to go down in history as me just getting the weirdest I possibly can in book club. thank gosh it's my book club, or I wouldn't invite myself back. But just having that opportunity to read it now and have those thoughts was really wonderful, and I think I can see why it is such a well-regarded book, because it constantly invites this engagement with it.
Yeah, I think that's right, and because, you know, I think from my perspective, the excision of that chapter 18 was the right one, right decision, because what gives the mystery its power is the ambiguity of it as well, that it's kind of what did happen to these girls and where are they now, and it allows for so many interpretations, so many conspiracy theories, so many ties to other works of literature and to other readings. And if you're reading it now, you can apply all kinds of post-colonial readings, you can apply some queer readings. I really enjoyed analysing the relationship between Mike and Albert through that lens. The story gives so much, and the fact of its openness is what I think allows it to endure.
Yeah, thank goodness they excised that chapter.
This just strikes me as a book that was so before its time, insofar as this would be so much fodder for social media and YouTube. This is the sort of narrative that invites scores of subreddits and videos discussing what the true meaning of it is. And it's so great that we have a chance to do this. But imagine if it came out today. it would be, social media would be alive discussing this, and some of the plots and twists that we've been going for here.
For sure. It reminds me of something like Donnie Darko from what, a decade or two ago, with the kind, and which was also then ruined by the director's cut. So it tells you that if you give away too much of the mystery, you ruin the story.
It's true. And a young Jake Gyllenhaal would be perfect as Albert. That was a brilliant casting, Elena. And that might be a point before we cast a really strange version of Picnic at Hanging Rock. It is the Australian Classics Book Club. I am speaking with Romy Ash and Elena Gougoulis. We have been discussing Joan Lindsay's Picnic at Hanging Rock. Romy, Elena, thank you so much for joining me. That's it for this great conversation in the Australian Classics Book Club. I want to thank Elena Gougoulis and Romy Ash for joining me to discuss Joan Lindsay's Picnic at Hanging Rock. Now, Great Conversations is recorded on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation at 2SER's Broadway Studios in Sydney, Australia. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. If you want to keep up with the latest in books, writing and literary culture, well, I mean, you can subscribe to this podcast. There's a new one every week. But you can also follow us on Twitter, Instagram and Facebook. Just look for @FinalDraft2SER. My name is Andrew Popel. I will be back next week with more great conversations from Final Draft. Till then, wish you happy reading.